This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Delroy Lindo is an incredible actor. He's one of the best to do it. His childhood was all over the place. He lived in London, then he moved to Canada. In his teens, he came down to the States. He ended up at the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. And he was a theater actor for about the first decade of his career. He got a Tony nomination. But Spike Lee changed Lindo's life. He cast Lindo in Malcolm X as West Indian Archie. It wasn't a huge part, but it made a huge impact.
You look like you're new in town. From what I can see, you're pretty handy with a buckle.
You got it coming.
Pull up a chair.
All of a sudden, Lindo was a movie actor. He was in Get Shorty, Gone in 60 Seconds, a bunch of Spike Lee pictures. Their most recent collaboration was Five Bloods. Lindo played a vet returning to Vietnam. If you saw that movie, you know how powerful Lindo was in it.
You will not kill Paul. You hear me? And the U.S. government will not take me out. I will choose when and how I die. You dig?
Delroy Lindo's latest project is the Hulu show Unprisoned. It's about a father named Edwin and his daughter, Paige. They're working on their relationship. Edwin is smart, handsome, charming, charismatic, and just got out of prison. Paige is his support on the outside, only she's feeling pretty mixed about the whole thing. Actually, she is feeling very mixed about the whole thing. Lindo plays the father. The daughter is played by Kerry Washington. In this clip, Edwin, the dad, is fresh out of the halfway house. He's reunited with his daughter, and his parole officer wants to know, where's he going to live?
Once a week, check-ins for drug testing and career counseling, and I assume he'll be living with you?
Oh no, that's a no-go.
Absolutely not.
But we do recommend parolees live with family to give them the best chance of staying out.
Yeah, no, of course, that makes sense. But I only have two rules, and one of them is that he cannot live with me. The other is don't ask me for money.
But what my daughter doesn't know is that I'm out for good this time, and you're going to see for your last.
I have heard this before. In 1986, 1992, 1998, actually December of 97, and then most famously in 2005. So what's different?
What's different is that I mean it this time, Paige.
Delroy Lindo, welcome to Bullseye. So happy to have you on the show. So happy to get to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this show isn't a sitcom, but it is television comedy. And I wonder if that was something that had ever been offered to you or that you had ever thought about doing.
Every now and again, comedic work has been offered to me, but usually it is accompanied by there's a comment, well, we understand he's not known for doing comedy. In this instance, Kerry and Tracy, in our first couple of conversations, described the aspiration for this work as a dramedy. And so I understood, or I had an understanding, that it was, a mix of comedy and drama.
Do you think of yourself as being funny? I'm not asking you to brag on yourself. What I'm asking is, do you find in your career that you're like, man, I'd like to do more of that? I think I'm as good at that as I am at the other thing.
Well, comedy is difficult. I mean, acting is difficult. Do I aspire specifically to do comedy? I guess I would say yes, from the standpoint that it is another opportunity to show range in one's work as an actor. And so from that standpoint, you know, I'd like to get a crack at doing a range of work. And I think I have to an extent, but certainly, you know, out and out comedy has been a smaller part of the work that I've done. Look, I don't know. I'm thinking Get Shorty. That's a comedy.
And you're really funny in it too.
Thank you. And if I were to stretch my brain further, I could probably think of a couple of other comedies, but you know, certainly Get Shorty was a comedy, and it was towards the beginning of my film career. So, yeah, I'd like to do more of that.
I mean, I feel like one of your greatest strengths, I mean, obviously, like, I think people probably offer you work on the strength of your presence, you know, the intensity that you're able to bring, the physically, emotionally, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But to me, one of your greatest strengths as a performer, and one of the things I enjoy watching in your performances so much, is how good you are at being sly. Mm. That there is, you know, you can play something head on for sure. You're fully capable. But like, I really enjoy watching you play someone who's got a trick up their sleeve. Mm-hmm. Or knows one thing more than the other people in the scene, mm-hmm. or, you know what I mean? That kind of thing.
I do. I think I know what you mean. The thing is this, it feels to me that that's very lifelike. I mean, not that quality in me per se, but the aspect of people communicating on one level externally, but internally they may very well have a whole other agenda going on internally, and that happens in life all the time. So perhaps your recognition of that in me is in fact a recognition or an acknowledgement of kind of a lifelike quality. And let me say one other thing about going back to your original question. The thing that, as comedy, as far as comedy is concerned, the thing that Get Shorty and Unprisoned have in common to an extent is that it's good writing. I remember reading when I read the Get Shorty script for the screenplay for the first time, it felt, whoa, this is terrific writing, because initially I was not aware that in fact it was based on the, I mean, even though it said it on, I had not at that point read the Elmore Leonard book, so I didn't know that the source was terrific. So I think what Get Shorty and Unprisoned have in common to an extent is the fact that, A, it's well-written material, even though I'm not making a comparison between Get Shorty and Unprisoned, but what I'm saying
is different things for sure.
Very different animals. But what I am saying is, on some level, the comedy comes out of the situations that the people are in.
We've got more from my conversation with Delroy Lindo still to come. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. family, work, living a fuller life, Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, beautiful people. I'm Jarrett Hill.
And I'm Trayvell Anderson. And we want to know, have you ever had mixed feelings about the things that you love?
Ooh, maybe about the things that you hate?
Then Fanti is the show for you. Fanti is the podcast for all those complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives.
You might have conflicting feelings about Kamala Harris or propaganda or interracial friending.
That's all right, because we do too. And we get into it every single Thursday. Catch this Slayworthy audio at MaximumFun.org. That's MaximumFun.org/Fanti. That's F-A-N-T-I. Come get all this good good.
Or this great gray.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Our guest is Delroy Lindo. He's a veteran actor. He's been in movies like Malcolm X, Crooklyn, and The Cider House Rules. These days, he's starring on the TV show Unprisoned. It's about a father who reconnects with his adult daughter after serving 17 years in prison. There's some comedy, there's some drama, and Lindo is extraordinary at both. Let's get back into the conversation. I happen to have a clip from Get Shorty right here.
So oh, that's hilarious. For real?
I think we should listen to it. So your character, so this movie is, and the book are about a mobster who goes to LA to basically end up breaking into show business. That's John Travolta's character, Chili. And he ends up writing a script and it's like caught up in some stuff. And your character is a shady investor in the project that he needs to shake loose in order to move forward.
But it's interesting. You're describing it and you're laughing already, right? So it's, yeah. it's kind of sort of inherently funny, but please
I sure love Elmore Leonard. Like I got to interview him one time while he smoked menthol cigarettes on a hotel balcony.
Because
he wasn't allowed to smoke in the hotel room. And it was just a real highlight of my career. But it's a wonderful movie. So this is a scene where your character knows that John Travolta's character is trying to shake him loose, but your character wants to stick around.
But what do you think of the script?
Well, the first thing that's got to go is the title. I mean, this writer's name, Murray Saffron, would be better than Lovejoy.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. You know what I'm thinking? Why don't you and I, we sit down, we write the script over where it needs it.
You could write one of these.
There's nothing to it. All you do, you get an idea, you set down what you want to say on paper. Then you hire somebody else to fill in the commas and where they belong, if you're not positive yourself. Maybe fix up the spelling where you have some tricky words. Although, I've seen some scripts, I know the words weren't spelled right. There was hardly any commas in it at all. So I don't think that's too important. All right, you get to the end. You write in, fade out. You're done.
That's it.
That's it.
That's all there is to it. Then what the do I need you for?
When you were making that movie, you were relatively new in the movie business. You had done a lot of theater acting.
Yes. But, yes.
What was it like to be in a satire of a world that you yourself were still kind of getting the lay of the land of?
That's a really good question because it's causing me to recollect. I'm not sure that I'm going to answer your question, but there are a couple of recollections that I have that may not be actually responding to what you've asked me. There were a couple of very significant differences on Get Shorty. So the first thing that I recall is being in the meeting with Barry Sonnenfeld and the casting director, whose name I can't remember. I don't remember. But it was my first meeting on Get Shorty. And I was in the meeting, and Barry Sonnenfeld and I were talking. And then he said to me, okay, should we read a few, you know, let's read a couple pages. And the casting director said, oh, no, he's not auditioning. This is just a meeting. And internally, I'm thinking, yeah, right. I'm not auditioning. We're just talking. But I was stunned because even though I had not auditioned for the last two films, the previous two films that I had done, which were Crooklyn and Clockers, directed by Spike, I had auditioned for Malcolm X, but Spike actually just offered me, excuse me, on the strength of what I had done in Malcolm X. Spike just called me up and offered me Crooklyn and Clockers. So in this Get Shorty meeting, I really do not recall whether it had been presented to me as an audition or just a meeting. I really do not remember. But what I do remember, when Barry Sonnenfeld said, let's read some words, and the casting director just said, no, this is not what's happening here. And I was very pleasantly surprised. Then I got a second meeting with Barry, the casting director, and a couple of other executives. Danny DeVito was there. The people who were involved with Jersey Films, Michael Schamberg, Stacey Scher, I believe her name was, and Danny DeVito. I think they were at the time partners in this company, Jersey Films. And I was asked to go and meet with all of them. And so I went. And Barry Sonnenfeld had said to me, the only thing that I ask is that you, when we start working on this, you talk really fast. Just keep talking, talk really fast. So I remember going into the room, even though I was not specifically asked to read any pages from the script, but I went into the room. And I said, I just wanted you guys to know that I can talk really fast when you need me to. And if that's really what's required, I can do that. No problem. Hands down. It's not a problem, you guys. So, you know, whatever you guys decide, hey, it's good. I can talk fast. And we were sitting at this long desk, and Danny DeVito was sitting at the end of the desk. And he said, and he leaned over to one of his partners, either Stacey Scher or Michael Schamberg, I don't remember. And Danny DeVito said, he's got this. Come on, let's just get out of here. Come on. And that was a revelation to me, because it was the first, aside from Spike, you know, big studio film that I would be doing with big movie stars. And on some level, it was, oh, if this is the way it is, I like this. I'll take this all day long. And then the other thing about my first day of work on the Get Shorty set, I walked into my trailer, and there was a big Adidas bag, and it was full of stuff, sneakers, sweatpants, and sweat tops. And I remember I looked inside the bag, and I said, "Ah, this is a mistake," and I picked up the bag. And I went outside and I spoke to one of the ADs, the assistant directors, and I said, "Oh man, look here, this bag was in my camp. It's not for me. It must be a mistake here." And the cat said, "No, that's for you." And I said, oh, I really like this. So they, I don't know if I answered your question, but they are two very, very, two or three very specific recollections that I have that separated after coming from the theater, working in the theater, separated my experience as a film actor from my experiences working in the theater or even working on with Spike.
So how long did it take for you to feel like you weren't a visitor in film?
Huh. That's another really good question. That's a really good question, and I'm not being facetious. I'm really not being facetious. I'm not sure that I've ever... No, if I'm honest, that's a great question, and I would say to you, I'm not sure. I'm not sure when or if I've ever had that conversation with myself. I'm really not sure. I think as I sit here today and respond to that question, I have a certain comfort level, internal comfort level that I can work well for and with the camera. But I'm not sure when I felt that internally. Again, I have a recollection of something that doesn't really address your question, but it was an interesting internal shift for me. And that was when Malcolm X, after Malcolm X had been released and had been in the theaters for a few weeks, I actually had been out of the country working on another film. And I came back to New York and I was walking down Lexington Avenue. It was Lexington Avenue in the 20s. And an African-American couple came were walking toward me. And as I got within earshot, the sister said to the brother, oh, that's that dude from Malcolm X. And that was the first time that that had happened for me. And it was, oh, wow. Because I was not at all prepared for the impact that my character in Malcolm X, the character I played, West Indian Archie, I was not at all prepared for the impact that that character had in the film. Because in a 3-hour film, I think that I, as an actor playing West Indian Archie, was probably only in the film, I mean, I would say less than 15 minutes. But the impact was significant, and I was not prepared for that. So the reaction to my work in Malcolm X was very different than anything I had experienced up to that point. But to your question, I'm really not sure if there was ever a time when I said, oh, okay, I'm a film actor now. I don't know.
I mean, I'm talking to you from the Bay Area, right?
You are.
So I'm from the great city of San Francisco, born and raised.
Oh, okay.
But I'm in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And I'm not even really in show business. I do comedy podcasts and a public radio show.
I could tell that, man, from talking to you. I said, this cat's not experienced. I mean, I could tell that.
You take one look at my face, you can see that I'm not really in show business.
Which explains why this is not an audio visual. This is why it's
my
just
television
audio.
Show ran for 3 months. I had to move to LA, right?
Yeah.
I was like, there came a point where it was like, if I want to do stuff, I got to be in LA.
Yeah.
And I've gotten used to it. You know,
yes.
I like it pretty well. You live in the East Bay, right? In Oakland or something?
Yes, I do.
So that's a choice that you made. And at some point you made a choice not to move to New York or LA.
No. I lived in New York for many years and certainly working as a theater actor, I was based in New York City. And I lived in New York for the first 10 years of my acting career, working as a New York City-based theater actor. And then I still have a place on the East Coast close to New York. So I've always maintained my New York connection. I did make a choice not to move to Los Angeles because I have always felt that I felt then at the beginning of my career, and I've always felt that L.A. would not be a good mix, be more specific, that my personality and the personality of the city of Los Angeles would not be a good mix. And so, yes, I made a conscious choice not to move to Los Angeles.
Did your film career allow you to move to Oakland?
Well, evidently it did. but.
Because you're talking about 10 years. I'm trying to put a timeline together in my head. And if you're talking about 10 years or so into your career in New York, that's right around the start of your film career.
Well, let me say this. Let me explain. I had gone to school in the Bay Area. I studied at the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco in the late 1970s. My theater career started in New York. I moved to New York and worked from 1979 to the early 1980s, pretty much exclusively as a theater actor. Every now and again, I'd get a day part on a soap. I did some soap work, and I did a couple of smaller parts in films that came to New York, feature films that came to New York and cast actors out of New York. I moved back to the Bay Area in 1996. So by 1996, I had done the three films with Spike, Malcolm X, Crooklyn Clockers, and Soul of the Game, HBO. I had done Ransom with Ron Howard and Mel Gibson. So when I moved back to the Bay Area in 1996, yes, my film career was off and running, and it was in the ascendancy. In retrospect, yes, I must have apparently felt secure enough, even though it was at the beginning of my career, relatively speaking, I must have felt secure enough that, which actually turned out to be a mistake. I felt secure enough that I could anticipate continuing to work in film without moving to Los Angeles per se. So the fact that I was familiar with the Bay Area, having gone to school here, I had friends in the Bay Area, made the Bay Area a doable compromise.
When I was a kid, my dad taught at USF, University of San Francisco, for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the highlights of my adolescence, and I guess this would have been shortly before you moved to the Bay Area, but one of the highlights of my adolescence was my dad had this horrible car that he had inherited, a 1977 Chevy Nova.
Mm-hmm.
That was metallic brown. It was a horrible car.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it was it was the first time we had had a car. So it was exciting that we had a car.
Right.
And the car broke down, or the battery died in the parking lot at USF. And, my dad came home one day and he's like, "Oh, my car died in the parking lot at USF." And Danny Glover gave me a jump.
I knew you were going to say something about Danny. I knew you were going to say something about Danny. I love it.
And like, there's a short list of people who chose to be in the Bay while working in show business and
yes.
had that kind of success, right?
Yes.
And Danny Glover is one of them.
Absolutely.
You know, when I was a kid, there was, you know, Whoopi Goldberg was making movies in the Bay and Robin Williams. And, you know, there are people who have chosen that, but it's a short list. You were on that list, and I can't imagine that you didn't know Danny Glover before you moved back.
No, well, Danny was one. When I referenced having friends in the Bay Area, Danny was absolutely one of them. One of the premier friends that I had. And he, while he was not the reason that we moved back, the fact that Danny was here and we were friends, and in fact, when we started, when my wife and I started looking, we had a place in Englewood, New Jersey, right outside of New York City. And when we started looking for a house in the Bay Area, we would come out and we would stay with Danny. We'd stay at his house. So when you started that story, I said, Danny figures into this somehow. So, and it sounds like a very Danny thing to do, just to stop and give a cat a ride. It's great.
I mean, I get the impression that he chose to live in the Bay because, you know, such a huge part of what he has done in his life is activism.
Absolutely.
And, you know, San Francisco is a place where that can be your life. I get the reason I mention that is because I get the sense from you in your career that there is a significant part of you, at least coming out of ACT in the 70s, who was committed to the idea that we can do acting, whether it's, you know, theater or something else, and impact the world. That acting was an act of, you know, furthering social justice.
That's true. That is very, very true. And I'm sure that I'm almost positive that the reason that you're quoting that is because you've heard me reference that in other interviews. And that's true. In 2023, it sounds almost quaint that one could believe that the theater could change the world. But yes, I did come out of that ethos. I absolutely did. I would say to you, the reason for my not moving to, the reason for my moving back to New York when I left ACT rather than moving to Los Angeles had nothing to do with activism. It had to do with the fact I distinctly remember feeling that I will be typecast. I know what I look like. I'm a big, dark, black man. And I'll be typecast if I even get offers to do anything in Los Angeles. I just feel like I'll be typecast based on how I look rather than being given an opportunity for whatever talent that I have as an actor. And because I knew that in New York City, being a theater town, that I would hopefully, knock on wood, get more opportunities to work as an actor and explore the craft of acting, it was a no-brainer for me. I'm going to New York because I want to work in the theater and explore my craft. So that's what my decision was. That's what caused me to move to New York. And I also felt, and I'm sure you've heard me reference this in other interviews, I just felt that I needed to, as an actor, learn the craft. Even though I had studied at the American Conservatory Theater, I wanted to continue exploring and studying and honing my instrument as an actor. And I hoped that in doing that, when and if I ever got the opportunity to work for the camera, I would have more to bring to my work as an actor working for the camera. And that's kind of the way it worked out, even though at the time there was obviously no guarantee that that would happen. But my decision to move to New York had to do with wanting to engage the craft and just get better as an actor, technically.
One of the things about Unprisoned and your role in performance in Unprisoned that I really enjoyed is, so your character is getting out of a federal penitentiary, is some kind of serious criminal, we know right from the start. Don't fall backwards into it, but you have the body and the presence for it. You're 6'4" or something like that. You're a big dude.
6'2".
And your performance is a very light one. It's a it's a pretty sort of warm show for the subject matter.
And when you say light, you don't mean lightweight, right?
No, I mean that it does not call upon you very often to be threatening, for example, right? Like you could be, and there is, we can see in your body that this is somebody who's been through that trauma that requires occasional threateningness, but... or at least capable of passing through that physically, right? But like, you're pretty fun in trying to figure out how to love and be a happy real person in the real world.
Okay. I'm going to attribute that in large measure to the person who inspired the part of Edwin, and that is Tracy McMillan's father, Harold. There are a couple things that I want to speak to. I am being released from a halfway house. So I have already, and these elements are really important from the standpoint of how to approach this work and how to approach playing this part. So I'm not being released. I've been in the penitentiary, in and out of the penitentiary. In and out of the pen over the years, absolutely. But I'm, in fact, being released from a halfway house, which means that I have, as you, I'm sure you know, I have begun the process from the experience of being in this halfway house of interacting, reconnecting with society. So it's not as if I'm being actually released from the pen, per se. That's one.
That's why your anklet's coming off in the first scene. It's not the prison gates opening.
That's
or
exactly
whatever.
Right. That's exactly. So that, and that's an important distinction to make. An equally, if not more important distinction to make is that this character, Edwin, having been inspired by Harold McMillan, Tracy McMillan's father, when I met Harold, Harold had a light touch. Tracy said to me, and I will never forget, Tracy said to me, and this was really a key in for me to how to approach this character. She said to me, if you met my dad, you would never know. If somebody hadn't told you, you would never know that this is a man who'd been in and out of prison over the years, and that was a key to me, and it became part of the ethos of the show in a sense, because the part of the point of what we're trying to communicate to actors is that these are human beings, in the final analysis. And there is such a thing, and there should be such a thing as redemption. And I know that that's a hackneyed, in some instances, hackneyed and overused term, but people do deserve a second chance. And somebody like Harold was somebody who did not possess that I saw. He was not a man who walked into a room and one thought, oh, who's that dude? He had a grace. He had a charm. Funny as hell. I mean, had a sense of humor, even about his own foibles. And they were characteristics that I chose to investigate in my, as I started working on Edwin, because they were exactly the kinds of characteristics that many people might not necessarily associate with an ex-con. And partially, that's the point. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So the components that you, or the characteristics that you reference on many levels are characteristics that Harold himself possessed that I am now mining as I create Edwin.
You corrected yourself when you said based on and changed it to inspired by. So...
Yeah.
What was it about this character that you or the showrunner or creator felt should be different from this real human being that lived in real life, lives in real life?
Because I guess I want to believe that I'm smart enough to know that it wouldn't have worked. for me to try to do an impersonation of this man. We're very different. And on some level, my options creatively were broadened immeasurably in making the decision and agreeing with my Carrie and with Tracy that I would not be doing an impersonation of Harold, but rather I'd be selecting unilaterally, frankly, I'd unilaterally be selecting certain components and using those components as points of departure for whatever it was that I was going to create.
Did you say the unilateral part to them? Like, did you say, I know this is your dad, but at the end of the day, I'm gonna choose the things that end up in my performance because I'm the actor. I'm the one that's on screen.
Right. That sounds kind of
That sounded ruder than I meant it to.
Yeah.
But.
So yeah, I didn't put it in those terms. We all agreed that the way to go was to use Harold as inspiration. And that's what Tracy wanted. That's what Carrie wanted. We all agreed that that would be the smart way to focus in on this work. Look, I played Satchel Paige, right, in a film that I'm really proud of, a film called Soul of the Game. Similarly, and in preparing to do that work, I read everything that I could get my hands on about Satchel Paige. Obviously, Satchel Paige was long gone. This was in the mid-1990s. But I took elements that I gleaned from reading all this material about Satchel Paige, and I used them as points of departure for whatever my rendition of Satchel Paige would be. I was never, ever trying to, I couldn't impersonate Satchel Paige, nor was it my desire, nor was it the desire of the director. But what we did want to do was to, and he pretty much left me alone, the director, Kevin Rodney Sullivan, to do my own work. But I was clear that even though I was playing Satchel Paige, quote unquote, I was also selecting certain characteristics that I gleaned Satchel Paige had and then building on that. And even similarly playing Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, a man who I never met the man. I don't need to meet the man. Diametrically opposed on so many levels, but similarly, I certainly was not trying to impersonate Clarence Thomas, but rather discover if there were any similarities between he and I, and build on that as I created, my version, my iteration, my interpretation of Clarence Thomas.
This show is based on the life of its creator.
Yes.
These are stories that have sprung from a real human being's real life.
Yes.
But when this show came to you, you must have been struck by the way that the themes, even just in the pilot, are connected to things in your actual life.
Ish.
I mean, this is the things I'm talking about. Uh-huh. And tell me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about you relating directly to your character necessarily. What I'm saying is, number one, this is a story about a character who had an absent father and like very mixed circumstances of being raised.
Mm-hmm.
She has a foster family in the picture. She has her father's partner in the picture. She has all these different things going on. Big part of the foster family situation is race.
Mm-hmm.
And you yourself grew up with an absent father. You were an immigrant multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And part of your childhood, you had not legal foster parents, I don't think, but like when your mom was in nursing school,
mm-hmm.
She wasn't allowed to have kids on campus. So
right.
you lived with a white family in England where you grew
right.
up part of your life.
Right.
So and I wonder if that made this show more appealing or whether you were like worried about it. You right. know what I mean?
I was not worried about it at all. And I guess I have to say, bravo, you've clearly done some homework or you've looked at, you know, interviews that I've done. So all of the, pretty much a lot of what you said is accurate. One thing I recall, one element that I recall we all shared in, I think our very first Zoom call, if not the second Zoom call, we all spoke about, broadly speaking, not in the specific, I really need to be clear about this, but we all referenced that we had daddy issues. It's also very important for me to say to you, there was no script initially. There was a conversation between myself, Carrie, and Tracy. In
That's
which
Kerry Washington, star of the show, and Tracy McMillan, the creator of the show.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, Kerry. Yes, exactly. There was a conversation about what we hoped to achieve with this work. There was no script. so, what I was responding to was the content of the conversation, and then as far as the content of the conversation was concerned, there were a couple of elements. We all referenced that we had had, it wasn't so much about daddy issues, but it was, we all were recognizing that we have certain kinds of dynamics present in terms of our relationship with our fathers. Certainly, Tracy and I, I mentioned that, yes, I had been unofficially in the foster system, that I had been in the system as a young person. Tracy obviously has, so we had that in common, even though our experiences were very, very different. But to your question, none of that scared me. None of that scared me, but rather it was, I had an awareness that that may be part of my way into this world and this character.
We'll wrap up with Delroy Lindo in just a minute. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, historians, authors, athletes, and more about why people do the things they do. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen. This message comes from NPR sponsor, MassMutual. According to Calendar.com, the average person schedules just 4.5 hours per year on finances. MassMutual gets it. Life is busy. If you can't find time to plan your financial future, find someone who can, like a MassMutual financial professional. For the last 170 years, they've helped people plan for retirement, college tuition, and any other short or long-term financial goals. Learn more at massmutual.com.
Since we reached our highest milestone during the Max Fun Drive, we are creating a Max Fun Foley library full of sound effects from your favorite hosts. The whole Max Fun community will be able to use it. So, what would you like it to feature? People high-fiving? Walking through mud? Chicken clucking? Jazz kazoo? Head to MaximumFun.org/Foley. That's MaximumFun.org/FOLEY and submit your ideas. We're excited to make this silly thing together and even more excited to see what you all create with it. And thank you again for a great Max Fun Drive.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking today with Delroy Lindo. His latest project is the comedy series Unprisoned. You can stream it on Hulu. You had a really incredible performance in Five Bloods. And it was one that was very resonant for me because I grew up with a dad who was a Vietnam vet.
Oh, dang.
And
Oh, wow.
And he worked with vets through much of my childhood. He was an organizer and, you know, he worked in the peace movement. He worked for an outfit in San Francisco called Swords to Plowshares. And when he was getting sober, when I was little, it was after he split up with my mom, but before he remarried. And so sometimes I would be there and we would go to meetings.
Okay.
And they would be vets meetings. My dad went to a lot of vet specific meetings. And so when I was little, I just spent a lot of time as a 7-year-old sitting in the corner drawing while vets talked about vet stuff.
Yeah.
And sobriety.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just lived with a lot of trauma through that.
I really hear you.
My father's trauma and PTSD and, you know, many, many of the people that he knew and people he was attracted to being friends with and were people that get that.
Yeah. And thank you I really appreciate you sharing that, man. I appreciate you sharing that about yourself. But please, what's your question?
My question is that Five Bloods is largely a movie about how you engage with trauma in your life.
Yeah.
And first of all, I wonder how you came to understand war trauma and how it affects people's lives to the extent you were able.
Right. First of all, I'm going to say that it sounds, based on your description of your dad, that God bless him, he found, no matter what his experiences with PTSD may have been, he was able to find constructive outlets for himself. Is that fair?
Oh, you very much so, yeah.
Yeah, thank God and God bless him. And God bless him. And I hope that meant that your relationship with your dad or the circumstances that you were in with your dad were not as dire as maybe they might have been.
Yeah, a lot better than they could have been. It's a fair characterization.
Amen. And that's fantastic. To your question, first of all, I will always consider the Spike gifting me that part, the opportunity to play that part, is exactly that, a gift. And I'm so proud of that work. I'm monumentally proud of that work. With regard to what I learned, I certainly became aware of my own relationship to PTSD. And I'm saying PTSD in quotes, radio audience, you can't see me. I've got my hands up in the quotes. I'm saying PTSD in quotes because I am characterizing this dynamic as it relates to me, my own relationship to my own trauma. And I mind that wasn't the be-all end-all of what I did in that work, but certainly I was mining certain aspects of my own trauma. And in some instances, making that work, I became aware of some things that I had not been aware of prior to starting that work. And the beautiful thing about that is that I could mine that stuff and bring it to the surface in service of Paul George and the narrative and the film overall. So certainly there were things that I learned about myself in the making of that work. And just as with your dad found constructive outlets to negotiate his PTSD. I would say broadly, my acting career, and I think all actors probably are dealing with their stuff through the prism of whatever parts they're playing. And certainly
I have done that in various work that I've done, but certainly with Paul in The Five Bloods, that was very definitely the case. And I did learn some things about myself in the process of making that work.
Did you feel some relief from it? I mean, you're a man, you were, you know, 67 years old or whatever when you were making that movie. But, you know, I know because I've seen it that that can happen at that point in someone's life.
Relief. I don't know that I would characterize it as relief. I would characterize whatever the experience of making that work gave to me, aside from the obvious creative benefits, I would say there's an added, I know more now. I know more about myself, a little bit more about myself, which I can now share parts of, perhaps, in a memoir that I'm writing. plug. a memoir that I'm writing. And in my writing, in the writing of this memoir, pretty much as a result of doing that film, I've been able to start unearthing some things that will be in the memoir that I wasn't necessarily aware of before doing that film. So is it relief? I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as relief, but I would characterize it as an added awareness.
You know, you didn't want to talk about yourself publicly for a long time in your career.
Yeah.
Like talk about your personal experiences.
Yeah.
And you went through a process of learning about your mother's life and the lives of your mother's contemporaries, people who came from Jamaica to the UK.
The Caribbean. Jamaican, but the Caribbean in general, but certainly, yes, in the case of my mom, Jamaica. Uh-huh.
Especially the British Caribbean, right? Because people could travel.
Absolutely. The British Caribbean. Yeah.
And it's a very different thing to have gotten to the point where you're writing a memoir.
No question. No question.
And like what I hear you describing to me, and I'm sorry if this is grandiloquent, but like what I am hearing you describe to me is acting as a way to keep from revealing yourself or to reveal yourself in such a mediated form that no one has to know you and being comfortable showing yourself.
All of the above. They're not mutually exclusive. All of the above. Depending on what the work is, depending on what the character is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And frankly, to the extent that, again, your dad finding the work that he found, helping your dad maintain a balance, that has been my work as an actor has been that which has helped me maintain a balance, mental, emotional, et cetera, balance. Yeah. You know, I've said in various interviews that, you know, acting saved my life, in quotes. But I say that literally and figuratively. And I am extraordinarily fortunate that I have had these outlets in my life, because I'm really not sure. Had I not had those outlets, I'm not sure what would have happened. But thank God that I have had these outlets and been able to make a living in the bargain.
And acting is, or can be, a home too.
No like question.
That's one of the special things about it, is that you have a family when you're doing it.
This is true. That's absolutely true. Yeah, no question. And, you know, to the question that you asked me 15 minutes ago, yeah, acting is home. Acting is a home, is a place of solace, is a sanctuary, even when it's rife with, you know, stuff. It's a place that, as you, to use your term, that is mediated, that is specifically focused, that is specifically
housed that one can express oneself, explore in the relative safety of either you know, a play in the theater or in for the camera in whatever project one is doing. So acting is home. The problem for me when I hear myself say that, it sounds really precious. It sounds so damn precious. And one does not want to sound precious. Look, on the one hand, it's home. It's everything that I just said. On the other hand, it's a job of work. And it's a wonderful job of work, but it's a job of work that one engages. But it does constitute, it has constituted for me and continues to constitute a safe place, a home in your, to use your terminology.
If it wasn't work, it wouldn't be the same thing. The work is the part that, I mean, that's the part that makes it stick.
Knock on wood, I hope so. I mean, that's the part that gives it value. Oh, that's part of the part.
But I mean, if it wasn't work for you, I'm not talking about the work as the product. I'm talking about the work as the process. Mm-hmm. So if it wasn't hard work for you, mm-hmm. if you weren't really working hard when you were acting, mm-hmm. it couldn't have that effect on your life or your traumas, right? Like it's, my dad used to say, go for a walk. You know what I mean?
Right. Absolutely. Right.
Like you got to do something.
You got to do something. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. And I'll tell you something else as it relates to Bloods, as it relates to Unprisoned, as it relates to some other pieces of work that I've done, the Cider House Rules, the films with Spike, the other films with Spike, when they touch, and there have been others, these are the titles that come to my mind as I'm having this conversation, but there have been others. But certainly another component of the reward for the work, to state the obvious, is the impact that it has on audiences. So that one does the work, one invests in this thing, in this process, and one does the work, and then the added component of the gratification and the affirmation that one attains when the audience responds so positively. One of the things that's been, certainly it happened with Bloods, I mean, there are various pieces of work that I can mention in which I've been communicated with by audiences who have seen the work, and it's just incredibly, I mean, it's deeply gratifying and affirming. And certainly that has been the case with Unprisoned. Some of the things that have been communicated, that have been said, that have been shared by journalists, by friends, family, audience members, have been really, really, really gratifying about what this work has meant and how it has touched people. So that's another component of having to do with the reward of making this work and being this kind of work.
And that you can feel to some extent like you're engaging in service.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's right. That's exactly right.
Because I imagine some days when you're an actor, you're thinking like, oh man, am I some actor? And you know what I mean? Like, oh gosh, here I am in show business and blah, blah, blah. I'm famous. And then maybe you can think to yourself like, oh, but actually I'm working really hard on something that impacts people's lives.
I'm working really hard on something that impacts people's lives. I cannot actually honestly say that I've never felt, oh my God, I'm in show business. You know why? Because it's too hard. Because it's too hard to make and sustain a career. I think it depends on the kind of work that one does and the kind of person that one is. I can honestly say to you, I've never felt, oh my God, I'm in show business. Certainly I've had instances where I feel like I'm barely holding on to something, but I've never, it's usually a question of feeling. Again, this is going to sound so precious, man, but really thankful
honestly, one, that I'm still here and still making work. I was talking with a friend of mine a few months ago, and we would, you know, we commiserate a very good friend of mine, and on some level, it's a skill. There are all these skills that one utilizes. You know, one goes to acting school and you engage, you know, learning the craft and becoming a skillful worker. But then it's also a skill to get your career up and running and maintain that career. That's a skill, because I'm sure you know, there's all kinds of garbage that one has to deal with and negotiate one's way through, which is what makes having an experience such as this and various other experiences that I've had as a worker, as a creative worker, that's what makes it worthwhile. Oh, that's one of the things that makes it worthwhile. And one must always be, again, I'm going to sound really precious, but one must always be profoundly grateful that one gets the opportunity to do that.
I'm very grateful to you for taking all this time to talk to me.
Not a problem.
It means a lot to me. Your work has been so incredible.
Thank you.
And I'm grateful that I've gotten to enjoy it.
Thank you so much. That does mean a lot. I really appreciate it. And
when I'm in Oakland tomorrow, driving up to Richmond, if my battery dies,
don't call
you're
me.
Responsible for everything from Treasure Island East.
So look here. This is what I'm going to say to you. Call Danny. Say, look, you did it for my pops. Come on, man. Do it for me. Call Danny Glover and tell him I said that.
Thank you so much.
All the best.
Really appreciate it.
Take care.
The brilliant Delroy Lindo. He is incredible on Unprisoned. Nobody has charisma and presence like Delroy Lindo. It is amazing. You can watch it on Hulu. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye, created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. I haven't been in Los Angeles, California, though. I got to go to New Orleans, Louisiana to officiate my best friend of 40 years, Pete's wedding. Congratulations to Pete and Christine. We basically spent 4 straight days crying. I also visited the Ogden Museum of Southern Art there in New Orleans. That is a cool museum. If you make it to New Orleans, man, that was a great place. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellows at Maximum Fun are Tabitha Myers and Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music composed and provided to us by DJW. The legend, Dan Wally. Our theme song is by The Go Team. It's called Huddle Formation. Our thanks to The Go Team. Thanks to Memphis Industries, their label, for sharing that music with us. You can find Bullseye on YouTube, on Twitter, and on Facebook. Follow us there. We share all our interviews. We love it when you share our interviews with your people. We really appreciate it. Recommend a Bullseye to somebody this week. It means a lot to us. I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. Whether you're planning a weekend away or an international adventure, All Trips Annual Travel Insurance can protect every trip you take for the next 365 days. Get a quote at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.